Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Janet Foster Show. And today is February 9th, and a lot of good stuff that's happening tonight. Back east, we are live, if you're listening to us live here at weplayradio.com. And, you know, we're bringing you the best of Los Angeles. And back east, there's something called the New Hampshire primary that went down, and just an hour ago, the polls closed, and we're going to get into that a little bit. That's going to be one of the main things that we're going to talk about. But what I want to do is just remind you that this is the show, as always, where you get real talk, where you can act on, and also you can get social with me right now, live. You can hook up with me on Facebook. I've got Facebook open right now. It's like Grand Central Station here. You can connect with me on Facebook and actually post there right now at Janet Foster. And you can also reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Janet D. Foster. And that's Janet D. for Deborah. And I just want to give some quick shout outs to some power listeners. Some listeners on certain medias, you know, I do interact a lot with you on Twitter. But some of my Instagram followers said that they wanted to get some more love. So I want to just give another shout out to Millennial Week. You always give me love. You give me love every week on the show, as well as you know, just help getting the word out about the show. And you've been with me since day one, since last summer when we launched this show. So thank you to Millennial Week. Also, shout out to new listener. She said she found me and she's so stoked to listen. I'm Natasha Galkina 3. So what up, Natasha? And thanks so much for the love. And also Jim Bloodsworth. Thank you so much for your kind words on Instagram. And Cynthia Taylor, 948. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So I just want to give some Instagram love. And, you know, as always, hit me up on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And, you know, I'll show the love back. Now, today, the New Hampshire primary just happened. Polls closed an hour ago, and the results are in. And I've got a great guest that's going to kind of we're gonna kind of hash it out a little bit. He's got a little experience about talking about this. And one of the things that, you know, we like to do here at the Janet Foster Show is we like to talk to regular people. And believe it or not, this is a regular guy, started a blog. He goes by the name of Citizen Jeff. That's his blog, and that's where you can find him. And he's also a founder of a nonprofit called Homefront Rising, and we'll get a little into that. We'll give him a little opportunity to talk about his nonprofit, because that's what we do here. We love to have activists here share their points of view and also talk about some of the good work that they're doing. So we definitely want to do that. And I just want to check, Jeff, are you there?
I am indeed here. You're spreading the love, so feel free to shower a little bit on me as well.
Oh, we got love, 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 love everywhere, so definitely. And I'm so happy that you and I could connect and chop up this New Hampshire primary kitchen table style a little bit and talk about kind of what's going on with the presidential
I like that you call me a regular guy. That way the expectations aren't too high. Nobody expects any actual expertise.
Well, you know, even when you've got multiple degrees and all kinds of other things, we're all just regular everyday people. I mean, that, you know, we're all doing things. So
that's especially true in this election season, because so many of the experts have completely missed it with Donald Trump. And I pegged it months ago that people are underestimating his appeal, and look out for this guy. And I don't know if it's because I'm not an expert or what, But people are in denial. And just before we went on, I was watching CNN. You should, the pundits there, their heads are exploding, trying to, you know, apologize for how they didn't get it. And now they're trying to catch up and make it seem like now they get Donald Trump. It's really funny.
It sort of is. And then it sort of is and then it sort of isn't. Because
I say it is. Well, why do you say it isn't?
Well, I say it isn't just from the perspective of being a traditional journalist, and I do take a lot of issue with a lot of the cable news folks. I'm sort of old school, but with new school education, and you know, and what I think too, Jeff, what you're going to bring to this conversation tonight, our audience is going to completely appreciate, because you know, our audience,
want me to forget this old school stuff. You got to join the 21st century.
Exactly.
This is the age of Trump is the age of rudeness.
Yes. Well, you called it right. It's rudeness. Some people call it snarkiness, but yeah. With an audience here of primarily Gen Xers and millennials, one of the things that as Gen Xers, for sure, and I know a lot of the feedback that I've gotten from millennials has been some things are just rooted in the past. And Donald Trump is pulling, particularly in the Republican Party, he's pulling a lot of the old heads. In the sense of some of the fear and ideas, because he's playing to a lot of fear, a lot of xenophobic thoughts. Whereas with Gen Xers and millennials, you've got two generations of Americans that have spent, basically all of us were born into a world where it was illegal to segregate. Mm-hmm. The laws were pulled down because Gen Xers, the oldest Gen Xers, were born in 1965. So you've got basically people 50 and under who in American society who have basically grown up from day one, from birth, in an integrated society. And quite a few in both these generations have had nothing but an integrated education in terms of public schooling. And then you get with the millennials, where you have in that generation, you have a majority of Americans that are multiracial. And multiracial in the sense of multi-ethnic, I think that's even better, because there's only really one race, that's the human race. But in terms of ethnicity, you've got more individuals that have backgrounds of one or more ethnicities, which means that the country is, in terms of its demographics, is coming together in terms of as a people, which also I think we're at this... fever pitch point right now, what we're seeing, whether it's whatever side you view, Ferguson to Baltimore, we're coming to this point where there were things that weren't discussed after things changed in the 60s. And now we're going to deal with them. And I think a lot of this election year is going to deal with that. And I also think that that's going to be quite indicative at the polls right now.
Can you just clarify for me, are you replying to what I said about Trump, or have you segued into another topic?
It's a combination of both. Because
either or is fine. I just want to understand whether or not you're disagreeing. Are you implying that Trump doesn't resonate with that segment of the population?
No, I'm not. I'm implying that who Trump is really appealing to, based on registration and voters, and this is fact, that an older demographic falls in line.
You're not wrong, but there's more. He appeals to more than that. I lived in New York during the 80s when Howard Stern was transitioning from a local act to a national act. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me a lot of him, both in terms of their personas and also in terms of the way the public reacted to Stern and how they're now reacting to Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. People thought that, you know, and even going back eons before then, Don Rickles even, you know, another insult comic. And I consider Trump a hybrid, and part of that hybrid is he is an insult comic. Mm-hmm. And so people who were offended by that, you know, they just didn't get it. And then when Howard Stern came along, they thought that he was just a bigot. And then it turned out he was very popular with minorities, not just bigoted white people. And I'm not saying Trump is exactly the same thing, but I think something very similar is going on. And if you look at what he has said about the Latinos or how Latinos are reacting to him and how everybody's reacting to him with respect to Latinos, they're missing it again. He never actually even disparaged Latinos.
How did he not disparage Latinos?
Well, I can't tell them not to be insulted. If they feel insulted, they're insulted. But I don't think what he said was meant to be an insult. What he did was he accused the Mexican government of sending over hardcore criminals. He didn't say that Mexico had any more hardcore criminals than any other nation. But everybody's reacting as though he said, you know, more than the average amount of Mexicans are rapists or this and that. He didn't say that at all.
He didn't say more than the amount. He did say that they sent rapists and murderers.
Correct.
And the connotation, the difference, Jeff, is the connotation between when you say things like that, it's dog whistling. In communications, it is dog whistling because of the demographic that you're dealing with. And when you deal with individuals who already have attitudinal issues with certain ethnic groups, and all you need is to hear someone say something like that, because people will interpret 10% of what they want to hear. And the 10% of what they want to hear is that you've got someone, you want the vote of someone who already has a problem with Latinos in this country, however they got here. There are people who are following the Trump campaign that have a complete anti-immigrant sentiment, and it's just not Latinos. It's everybody.
You're right.
But in particular, that group has been called out by him, and that's where that has gone. And the level of disrespect to the Latino community is what has happened. And it's been consistent not only with the Trump campaign, but it's been with other campaigns within the Republican Party. And that's the issue. And then you take it further, the vilification of the entire diaspora. And that's the problem that Trump has with Latinos. And it's,
I think we're having a disagreement here, but let's try to figure out what our
disagreement is. As a reporter, I don't have a side. I'm working. I just work with the facts happening.
You just described how he's going over with a certain segment of the population, and I agree. What I'm saying is I believe there are also people out there, and this segment of the population is being underestimated, who aren't as offended as what you just described. And the reason they're not offended is what I said. They don't really, it's not so much that you're wrong, it's that they don't care that he has a tin ear or he was insensitive or it came off this way. They just simply get he didn't insult Mexicans. And that's what I'm comparing to Howard Stern. Some people disapprove of that sense of humor. Doesn't mean that there aren't tons of other people who love that. People hate political correctness. And I think the people who underestimated Donald Trump also underestimated how many people hate political correctness. It's not just bigots who hate political correctness. Mm. The same people who love Howard Stern, and of course Howard Stern's audience includes bigots, but it also includes millions of people who aren't bigots. And I'm saying that's where there's a lot of appeal for Trump. Mm-hmm.
Now, you talk about political correctness, and that word surfaced as a term in the early 90s. And a lot of political correctness came around describing the Americans with Disabilities Act. And, you know, it's become a self-interpreted thing. And I think in the case of Trump, even within the Republican Party, political correctness is one thing versus decorum.
Yes.
And there's a distinct difference. And the man has no decorum. I mean, from just a personal perspective, usually I don't do this as a journalist, but from a personal perspective, I'm a fan of the guy.
You don't have a dog in the fight, but you may not be as unbiased as you claim.
I'm a fan of the guy in terms of The Apprentice. I think he puts on a good show.
Yeah.
And I'm a fan of the guy because I've stayed in his hotels before, and he has a good product. I'm a fan of the guy because he raised his children properly. And I've said this countless times, you know, our listeners, our listeners know, I admire how the man raised his kids, because to be wealthy like that, there are a lot of wealthy families in this country that have kids who are complete screw ups. And his children are not. They are college graduates and they are on point in business. And, but in terms of the presidency, and I've got Jeb Bush called it right. You can't insult yourself to the presidency.
See, this is what I'm laughing. This is, again, like Howard Stern. People have these rules in their mind, and then rule breakers come along. I think Trump, in one respect, is breaking the rules of the game, and in another respect, he's even going beyond that, and he's making up a whole new game altogether. You say he can't do it. And I think he can, and we'll see. I think he can.
Well, I think in terms of decorum,
some of the things he says makes me cringe. You know, and let's take what happened yesterday. Somebody at one of his rallies, a woman, said that Ted Cruz is a pussy, and Trump started laughing and repeated it. Now, it was in reference to Trump being all macho about torture, and I'm very much against torture. Mm-hmm. Okay? I don't like that he is getting people all wound up about wanting to bring back waterboarding and even worse than that. But I have no problem with him saying that Ted Cruz is a pussy or quoting that somebody else said it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as soon as he said it, I was looked on Twitter. What's his name? David Korn, the guy who used to be with The Nation, or maybe he still is, said another first in politics. You know, he's so prissy. This is another rule that he broke. And, well, I guess you can break that rule, you know, because he keeps breaking the rule.
Well, I mean, he can do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
And I think anybody can. But I think in terms of
you think it'll hurt him
being,
to the point that he can't overcome it.
Well, I mean, right now he's vying for the Republican nomination. And he's got an issue with the Koch brothers. I mean, that's rich boy stuff. I call it hashtag rich old dude problems. He has a huge problem with the Koch brothers. He is an outsider, even though he's wealthy. He's a complete outsider to the cocktail set that I like to refer to in the Republican Party. And that's the money. That's the money side of that makes the Republican Party go in terms of big financing, and not just the super PACs, but these are people who make the phone calls. He is an outsider, even though he went to Penn, an Ivy League school, but he didn't go. He wasn't in the inner circles, the Harvards, the Yale circles of the wealthy. And he does have a chip on his shoulder. And then you have someone like a Jeb Bush, who's from not only a dynasty family, but a very well-connected family. And when you think of the Republican Party, you think of old money, you think of decorum.
Right.
And he's not, he definitely doesn't have that kind of appeal not to just the cocktail set, but I think to even the top 3% income earners in the United States.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see. Like, New Hampshire has a lot of people. By the way, I think you said at the
beginning. He won it.
In case you didn't, we should say he won and Sanders won. But New Hampshire has a lot of people from New York who moved there. And so they're not as offended by by Trump's brashness and his vulgarity and so forth as perhaps other parts of the country. So it'll be interesting to see how his act flies in the South, for example.
Well, and it's funny you say act because he's also the time that he held up the Bible and was talking, that's just when I thought, this is pandering. And I just thought, this is going to be taught in a political science class somewhere where he's holding the Bible. He looked awkward because he was saying that this was the Bible, the same Bible that his mother gave him. And it's sort of like, this is just a thing I'm doing. I'm a rich dude. I'm a billionaire. And this is my hobby.
It's unusual in politics, Japan.
I think the last time we had a billionaire that it was his hobby, it was Ross Perot in 1992. And at least he was a little entertaining in the sense of he had the charts. He had flip charts. I'm waiting for Trump to do that as the businessman, but he's not. But I think to your point, though, the base that he's...
Trump is a smarter politician. He knows to dumb it down. Flip charts, nobody can follow that.
Exactly. And you mentioned a point earlier and the fact that you just said he's dumbing down what he's doing. That's who he's trying to reach. He's trying to reach the person who makes $50,000 a year, who is pissed off at the world because of their own bad decisions, but they vote Republican because they feel like everybody's getting something except for him, but they're going to support the billionaire because they're an aspirational voter, because they want to have rich people problems. But right now, they're basically on the broke ass train, as I call it.
But again, he's also appealing to others. I mean, there are plenty of very educated people who are very concerned about national security, mm-hmm. and they want a very strong stance. And so even though his style is very New York Street, dumbing it down, they're getting the message from him that he is very tough on that. So just because he's not speaking in highfalutin language doesn't mean that he's not appealing to them.
No, you're right. But I think that these Republicans are Republicans that they don't feel like they're being heard. And right now he's their guy. Mm-hmm. But the people who really control the Republican Party, it's not going to happen. I think
who has a bigger problem appealing to a broad audience is Bernie Sanders.
Yes.
His possible opponent, his co-winner in New Hampshire, let's call him.
You're true. We'll get on the Democrats in a moment. But with the Republicans, I think particularly in that race, and we'll go ahead and talk about what just happened in New Hampshire. Trump did win. Cruz came in second. And just for for our listeners, the delegates that are needed to win for the Republicans, they need 1,237 votes, basically delegates to get the nomination. And Trump won tonight. Ted Cruz came in second. Marco Rubio, in terms of overall numbers of delegates that they have, Rubio is still third. He's still cruising at third. Carson is still at fourth. Now,
I don't mean to interrupt. I just want to understand. You're saying these are where they stand after the caucus and this, or you're giving the results of just today?
Yes, after the caucus and today.
Yeah, because I thought I saw Kasich came in second.
Yeah, which we knew Kasich was going to do something. And actually, he's the one. I had a guest last week from the Young Republicans, National Republican Federation, and we talked a lot about that. And Kasich is one that I've actually been surprised that he hasn't done as well.
He's a boring dad.
Well, the thing about it is, of all of the candidates in the race, he is the most qualified, and he has the least number of liabilities involved. He's a current sitting governor, and he's pretty decent in his state across demographics.
He doesn't have the name recognition. And
name
he comes
recognition.
Like a boring dad, so it's hard to establish.
But in terms of his qualifications, He's the most qualified. He's even when you match him up to Jeb Bush, because he's had more success as a governor than Jeb. And
you think
I was,
he might be a sleeper who really comes, you know, continues to come on and surprise people.
I just something about Kasich. I think and two going into the general election, I actually think Kasich might be their only hope, because he's in a state where he can pull moderates and independents. And that's what the Republican lacks.
Yeah.
The Republicans lack. They don't
have that moderate
guy. And you're
right. He doesn't have those
guy.
Negatives that Rubio, Bush, and Cruz has.
Exactly. And I do. And like you said, I see him being a sleeper and I see him doing well. But I was really surprised.
Maybe the pun wasn't intended.
Well, I was very surprised, though, that he didn't do well in Iowa just because of the whole Midwest connection. Because generally in the Midwest, people kind of gravitate towards them. But my guest last week had mentioned that Kasich didn't really have very much going on in the ground in Iowa. And also there's kind of a traditional thing in Iowa where even if the person who wins Iowa, they never get the nomination. So it's sort of like, you know.
It might be a good strategy to try not to win.
Exactly. You know, it's almost
you're
like.
You're exaggerating. I can't remember the figures, but I saw there is a certain percentage of the time they've gone on to win.
They have, but not in recent yeah. years, and especially since the shifting of the electorate from the 90s. Because when the 90s happened, that's where the baby boomers took over as the largest electorate, and they've really had a problem with that. But I really thought he would pull it out, and I was very surprised that that didn't happen. Now in New Hampshire, I know his campaign put a lot of effort in New Hampshire, so for him to come in second the way he did, I can see those results, but.
I don't know if it has, if they have much influence. Also, the Boston Globe I saw endorsed him. Didn't the New Hampshire paper also endorse
yes,
him?
Yes, New Hampshire yeah. papers endorsed him, and
that's old school analysis, but I guess it still has some influence.
Well, it doesn't in the sense of I think in terms of what the people I think with what they're looking at and what the people are doing, but Trump. He did get 34% of the vote, which I thought was good. And Kasich, he got 15%. And
wow.
then Cruz got 11, which what was interesting now, because Bush put a lot of work in there. And, you know, that the cocktail set and, you know, they really that upper part of New England, the cocktail set really, you know, everybody has their summer homes there. And the Bush family has a strong imprint in that area of New England. And I think even Bush pulled out the mom card, his mom, Barbara.
Mommy card.
Yeah. You know, he's like, I got to call my mama. And what's interesting, though, is he came in close a few, percentage point, a few points behind Cruz. He was at 11.4%. So, that kind of helped, and he did put in a significant amount of resources in that state, and I actually thought he would come in at third. So it sort of is. It's sort of happened.
People are sick of all that dynasty crap. I mean, I wouldn't want to rule out somebody just because they're in a family that has mm-hmm. previously served, but they would have to be pretty damn good for me to get excited about that, because this dynasty, it's so absurd that it can't be that the best candidates just happen to be in the same family. There's something very wrong with that.
Well,
people are getting nauseated by that.
Well, and particularly Gen Xers, you know, anytime.
You're big with that Gen X millennial stuff. I'm trying to figure out how old are Gen, what's the difference between
the oldest?
Gen X?
The oldest Gen Xer is 50.
Gen
Xers were born between 1965 and 1979.
All right,
and millennials from 1980 to I think they cut that off until 2005.
Okay.
So, but and our views are different. And particularly though Gen Xers Gen Xers have seen two Bushes in our lifetime, and each time there's been a situation with banking. Gen Xers, when most of us were either in college or getting ready to graduate or graduated, you know, Papa Bush was in office, and the savings and loans collapse, and that jobs were hard to get. And that's sort of why we can identify with millennials when Baby Bush, when W was in office, and then we had the crash in 2008. And again, jobs were difficult. And with Gen Xers, we've been hit twice by Bushes in terms of financial gains. First trying to start our careers, and then in the middle of our careers, getting hit again. And for Gen Xers, it's going to be a lot different in terms of recovery, that's different from baby boomers when they recovered from both of these situations, because we never had any of the advantages that the baby boomers had, even in terms of the workplace. That's one of the reasons what drove in the 90s the new economy, because we thought the new economy would at least give us a chance. And then the millennials did the same thing, except they're doing it on the entrepreneurial side. But when capital is hard to get as a result of banks crashing, and then now with a lot of the changes that are happening and not too many incentives to move, you know, to expend capital, it's a little bit different. And then for Gen Xers, baby boomers are staying in the workforce longer, which means we can't move. So and so when you hear Bush, Gen Xers, they're not feeling the Bushes too well. It's just not, it just doesn't work. And then when you have millennials who, you know, they remember the dad, but they weren't affected because they were little kids, but then the son, and then they also identify with 9/11, and also in that generation, a large majority of their friends.
So then why did you think he would do better? Just because he put so much effort into this?
Well, the demographics of that area, and the amount of, I mean, he really had a lot of people on the ground, and they spent a lot of money. He spent just as much money as he did in Iowa. I mean, he spent about $15 million in Iowa and only got one delegate. And then he really started pushing it hard. And he was actually, he left Iowa last weekend. He was in New Hampshire. So he's been in New Hampshire working it quite a while. And just with the fact that the family has a presence there, I thought he would do a little bit better, but it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting as he moves south. And
so he was spending money on TV commercials.
He was spending on TV, and then you got to pay staff.
I think that speaks to what you're saying about millennials. Millennials spend more time on the internet than they do sitting around watching TV.
Well, but that particular area, though, millennials is in terms of population is low.
You mean they don't have that many millennials?
In that area of New England.
They have a lot of elderly people.
Well, you want to say people of means in that area, because it costs a lot. And in terms of when you're looking at majority of blocks, the majority population age-wise, that's where you're going to have that population. You may start to see...
Well, you really done your homework. I would assume that it doesn't cost much to live in New Hampshire because it's so cold.
No.
By the way, should we taunt your East Coast audience and tell them what the temperature was today here in Southern California?
Yeah, we should. We should
about
tell
87
them.
Degrees, 2 days in a row, not a cloud in the sky.
Yeah, and then last week they knew it was 55 degrees and we were feeling like we were in blizzard conditions too. So, but yeah, in terms of the Republicans, they definitely have got something going on. You know, I want to get your take real quick. Who do you think, you know, last week we had people dropping like flies. I mean, Huckabee finally said no. Santorum said no, he was done. And then Rand Paul went ahead. He suspended his campaign, but he's officially done. Who do you think should be next?
Should. That's the trickiest word in the English language.
Yeah, should.
Not for me to say. I'm happy for anybody to run. I was a Ralph Nader supporter back when people were saying he should drop out.
Oh, my goodness.
How it will affect. I would never say anybody should drop out. If they want to go for it, go for it. Maybe, and even if you reword it to ask me who I think will, I'm not even sure about that. As you said, I'm just a regular guy, and even if I had time to study today's results, I'm not sure I could come up with a good answer. But I do notice that, the Rubio, Bush, and Cruz trio had really, really low numbers, and you don't have to be an expert analyst to know that. That's got to have some sort of a psychological kind of PR effect. But neither one of them, I get the sense, is anywhere close to giving up. And I don't think that they view New Hampshire as a do or die situation.
Yeah, and you know who I thought did better than what I expected him to do was Chris Christie. He got
He took lessons from Donald Trump. Did you see him do that number on Marco Robot the other day?
Yeah,
you and I have different comedic tastes.
It's not so much the comedy. I just thought, you're just fighting for the gutter. That's what I thought.
It works.
Look, and he still lost, though.
Janet, even when it's more polite, they're all playing identity politics. It's not like it's all substance and very sophisticated and deep. It never is. So it's really not that big a difference. It's just a bit coarser. And I'm more entertained by it. I think it's funny.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely not boring watching the Republicans. And, switching over to the Democratic side, it was sort of predicted, and it's understandable that Bernie Sanders would win because he's from the area. He's been touted mostly as a regional candidate. I think after this week, we'll really start to get into the meat and potatoes, so to speak, of how is he really doing? He's from that area of New England, and he did pick up delegates, and he got 59% of the vote, which I thought he would get even more than that. And Hillary Clinton got 38.3%. And it's sort of the thing about Sanders, what makes him interesting, and I sort of get the same vibes from him as Dean Howard, is that,
Howard Dean.
Howard Dean. I'm
very sensitive to that because my name can be said backwards too.
Yeah. I remember Dr. He had such fire going into it, and then all of a sudden it just leveled off. And
it was just that one incident when he was yelling like a maniac, just one time. Bernie Sanders yells like a maniac all the time.
Yeah, the thing about Bernie is he's not a real Democrat. He's an independent who caucused with Democrats, while he was in the Senate. And he's had the best of both worlds in the sense of being able to say, I'm for this, I'm not for that. And I think his appeal is going to hit a wall as they start to get into certain states.
I love fighting for economic justice and that being a big part of the campaign. But you hit it on that. I don't know if it's exactly what you meant, but when you talked about anger and a vibe, we'll see. I can only guess how the rest of America is going to react, but I think his anger is really weird. There's nothing wrong with being angry in general. There's certainly a lot, but the way it comes out with him, what it reminds me of is the kind of anger you typically see only when somebody is arguing with you. Mm-hmm. But this guy, all by himself, it's like this anger bubbles up out of nowhere, all by himself, and it just looks freakish.
Well, he and people are going to see it, and I think people are going to get to know him a little bit better because he was an independent. I mean, his nickname is America's Senator because for the most part, for a lot of social causes and social issues that do come up in Congress, he pretty much works with the progressive side of politics. And most people are okay with that. And he's very good about calling out things. And a lot of that just has to do with the fact that he never had the responsibility or the expectations placed on him to contribute to, say, the Democratic Party platform. So he doesn't have those ties. And just to see how he's going to evolve is going to be very interesting. And I do find it, I'm not surprised that a younger demographic is following Bernie, because they're not aware of that. Most don't know that he hasn't been a Democrat. He just caucuses with them, which that's fine. And then I think with Hillary,
well, they perceive him as a man of the people and all that.
Yes,
that, of course,
because of his independent status, and that's the part that's what I'm finding so amusing, and watching this watching the evolution.
I'm not sure how much of a factor it would be. It might be just because it annoys me. but I hate authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. And he has a terrible authoritarian bent that doesn't seem to bother liberals. In fact, I don't even think they notice it. But the two clearest examples are Citizens United. He wants Congress to have the authority to imprison people just because they've spent money on expressing an opinion. And that's a very authoritarian position to take. Mm-hmm. And also, he voted for that watch list that would deprive presumably innocent Americans of the right to buy a gun just because the government says they're a shady character. Now, the liberals hate guns. They want gun control, and they want everything to be fair. So they don't object to it. But I think that when it comes time, if he gets the nomination, when it comes time to dealing with the general population, that might bite him in the ass.
Well,
The other thing is it takes away a reason to vote for him, to distinguish him from the Republicans. Like, Trump has all this authoritarian rhetoric. And if Sanders were to lose the authoritarian rhetoric, which he doesn't really need, and just focus on economic justice, you'd have more of a reason to vote for him. But mm-hmm. he's really just as authoritarian. It's just a different brand of it. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, not at all. Thank you for that point. You know, Bernie Sanders has more other liabilities. He voted against the Brady Bill. He's rejected both sides in terms of gun, just in terms of any type of sensible gun dialogue. He's rejected both sides, so he has an issue with both sides.
Some of it is understandable because of the state he's in.
Well, that's what he's claiming.
They don't have an urban crime problem with guns. So I don't really blame him for that. But nonetheless, it's a problem as far as the way he's perceived.
Well, see, and that's the thing. It's not just an urban crime problem. It's in general. And particularly, you look at Newtown. You take Newtown. I mean, it's an affluent area and it's suburban. And I apologize to listeners if this sounds crass, but I was very touched by that particular situation, and I've been touched by just as many as hearing about teens in Chicago or New York or Miami or even here in Los Angeles. But and I really thought when Newtown happened, I thought, okay, people are going to wake up. We've got to do something. Even Virginia Tech, people, we have to have a way of screening people to make sure people who have guns are mentally fit to have them. And if they have someone in their home who is not mentally fit, how it's locked up, what kind of liabilities, it's almost like you've got to treat these guns like as if they're your vehicles, just like for our vehicles, we have to have a license for them.
I don't want to correct me if I'm misrepresenting mm-hmm. what your thoughts are behind that, but I'm detecting something that I typically hear from the gun control crowd, which is when you say we have to do something.
It's better than nothing.
Well, yeah, but the problem that I see is the gun control crowd thinks it's primarily about a lack of resolve on their part, and also that they're up against unreasonable people, the NRA and so forth. And I don't think that's primarily the problem. I think what's primarily the problem is the lack of good ideas, because it's very, very difficult. You can't just decide to have a good idea. You know what I mean?
Right.
And the goal always has to be to balance public safety with the right to own guns for self-defense and so forth.
Right.
It always is the case. And it's a very, very difficult line to draw. And that's the problem, that it's difficult, not the lack of resolve or the NRA.
And I agree with you. It is difficult, but at the same time, it's something that you've got to try. Status quo is just not appropriate.
That's the same thing, though. What's the difference between what you're saying
doing
and
nothing?
The problem is the lack of resolve. Of course, I'm not saying stop trying, but the expectation is wrong. There already are tons and tons of laws pertaining to guns and ammunition. I'm not saying stop, go out of the business of legislating guns and ammo. I'm saying don't assume that that's where you're most likely to find a sea change.
Absolutely. It's not the end-all, be-all solution. But I really thought the dialogue in this country would change at the thought of dead kindergartners, and it didn't happen, and that the dialogue would get more mature.
I think they should go to the root of the, not that it's easy, there is no easy solution. Mm-hmm. It's a very long-term solution, but I think there's a greater potential to solve the problem or start solving it by focusing on why this is happening,
Right.
And I mean something as just basic as conflict resolution. Because we have people who, just because they're upset, they do this, they automatically lash out, they try to control. I'm talking about, at all levels, when you're having fights with your wife and your kids and your neighbors and your employers and employees. We have to get more principled about how we deal with conflicts when they arise.
Yes, that's one area. And also, I think to add to that would be mental health.
Yeah.
Dealing with it. It's no longer something that we can ignore.
Don't be so mental, people. Just be so mental.
Definitely about that. But yes, to wrap up this conversation on the Democratic primary, I do think that Bernie Sanders is going to have more liabilities. And his strong point is I think social issues, specifically economic justice, for sure, is one area for one segment of, I think, the Democratic Party. You've got a Democratic Party.
We didn't even talk about Madam Hillary yet. We're running out of time.
Yeah, we're going to have to come back to that, because one thing I wanted to...
She might be in prison by then.
I doubt it. I really doubt it. As long as, I'll put it like this. As long as Dick Cheney's not in jail, she won't either. but I want to move on to, because I mentioned to our listeners that you're a founder of a nonprofit called Homefront Rising. And I want you to share with us some information about your nonprofit, what you do, and how you got started with that.
Sure. Well, Homefront Rising, we kind of distinguish ourselves from all the other nonprofits out there, many of which are doing great work, by focusing on coming up with very innovative housing solutions and also developing income career solutions for veterans. And we're in the process of establishing an incubator to help veterans launch their own businesses.
Okay.
And the website is homefrontrising.org. You can see some housing designs by an architect named Carl Welty, who came up with a great project for Haiti after their earthquake back a few years. And we have the same kind of attitude towards veterans, in the sense that there should be the same sense of urgency to house veterans as there was to deal with an earthquake or, a tornado or any kind of a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that same kind of urgency. And another big thing that distinguishes us is that we believe very strongly in veterans and non-veterans working together. It's not just about helping veterans. Many veterans don't need help. Many of them are highly skilled. They're in great shape. They have talents that they acquired in the military And we need to harness this talent and apply it to the civilian sector. So we have a bunch of different projects, and there's not time to go into all of them. But if people go to our website, they can acquaint themselves with it. And it's homefrontrising.org. Okay. And can I slam one of the other nonprofits? Is there time for that?
Because it actually is it the one where they collected a lot of the money for executive salaries?
No, it's Paul Rykoff, who's the executive director of IAVA, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. And in general, I don't have any beef with that nonprofit. But when Donald Trump backed out of the debate and he had the event for veterans, Paul Rykoff announced that if he donates to us, we won't accept it. And I just want to say that is a terrible attitude, because money equals services. And it doesn't matter where the money is coming from, because the most important thing is if a veteran needs a prosthetic leg or a home or whatever it is, you shouldn't deny them those services just because you don't like Donald Trump. So anybody who wants to donate to Homefront Rising, we're not going to subject you to a purity test. We will gratefully accept your support, even if you're not a nice person.
Okay. Well, I have a question about your charity, your nonprofit. Now, is it a 501(c)(3)? So you do you also do charitable fundraising for your nonprofit. Now, do you work with homeless veterans, or are they veterans that maybe they've been discharged and they are they haven't found work and they're not able to buy a home? Or is it a home buyer program, or is it
The main thing we're doing is establishing veterans villages, communities. Okay. And the first property we have is in Pierce, Arizona. And if you go to our, you can actually go direct to that page by putting in operationmoss.com, or just click on the main page and find it from there. But what it is there's your veterans village, and each one will be a little bit different. But part of the property will be for housing, and part of it will be for services. So we may have, for example, a business incubator right there on the scene, as opposed to the more traditional kinds of services.
Okay.
So we are developing a template that to some extent can be duplicated, but not completely, because we want each property to have its own individual character based on what the locals want.
Okay. And you talk about veterans, and I have done shows where we've talked about veterans and some of their needs. And one of the things that we've noticed in Congress, we've had a Congress for the last 6 years that have voted against veterans bills, employment bills, funding, and it's groups like yours that seem to be more and more almost filling in the gap where maybe Congress should be stepping up a little bit more. Is your organization able to seek any type of federal grants, or is there some other, or even state grants or opportunities to help veterans too?
Well, just like any 501(c)(3), we are eligible for government grants as well as private and as corporate as well. And we don't get into fighting the legislation. Instead, we just, like you said, fill in the blanks.
Okay.
We offer an alternative. It's not, we just aren't well equipped to fight
to lobby and to see if we can get more. Because
I am. I come from show business. I know a lot of creative people, and who we are is about coming up with innovative solutions.
So private donors are just opening up their wallets.
We can get it. Private, corporate, government. But the point is, to us, it's like producing a TV show. We're creating concepts and, working with architects and designers and stuff like that. That's what makes us excited. And that's where our strength is. And it makes sense to stick with our strengths and let others worry about the legislation.
Got it. Well, with that point, that's going to be the last word tonight. But Jeff, thank you so much for joining me. And we'll definitely have you back.
Thank you.
Because we there's some good talk
here. We're going to have to schedule the next time sometime before Hillary Clinton goes to prison. And by the way, you made a bit. I like your priority. I love that you gave me the opportunity to talk about Homefront Rising rather than talk about Hillary. That's a very wise decision.
Well, we do what we can. But listeners, I want to thank thank you so much for listening. And I also want to thank my producer, Jeremy Hansen. You know, he makes everything go here at We Play Radio and makes everything possible. And, you know where we are. And you'll find us same place, same time next week. Have a great week, everyone.